Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com.
From the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 326, from Monday, November 20th, 2017. And here's what we have for you today. Ahead of Thanksgiving, a visit with John Shields, chef and cookbook author. But this time, instead of John coming to the podcast studio, we're going to his kitchen at Gertrude's Restaurant in the Baltimore Museum of Art. That'll be fun. Plus, John has every recipe you could need for a Chesapeake-style Thanksgiving dinner. So if you haven't thoroughly planned out your dinner already, you might want to hear what John has to offer. Sherry Parks is with us again. This time, our favorite culture critic wants to talk about three related things. Colin Kaepernick, the long list of high-profile men recently accused of sexual harassment and or assault, and the modern meaning of masculinity. Sherry will be joining us in just a few minutes, and then we'll go to Gertrude's. Or maybe we should go to Gertrude's first and then talk to Sherry. I'm not sure what we're going to do yet. Tell you what, how about listening for the next 2 minutes to Paula Gallagher's weekly book recommendation? Paula is a connoisseur of memoirs, and she really likes this new one by a Towson University professor named Jeannie Venasco.
Dan, this week I have a memoir called The Glass Eye by Jeannie Venasco. And this one is very interesting in the way that it's told. It's told in a series of short vignettes. And it's a memoir really that trades on familial love, grief, and mental illness. The author is writing going back and forth in time and her childhood in Sandusky, Ohio, born to a father who at that time was 62 years old and a mom who was 42, a father who had a previous marriage and previous daughters in that marriage. But this is the insular love amongst the family, that small family unit of three. The title comes from the fact that her father had a rare eye disease when she was young, and it caused him to lose his left eye. So now he's got that glass eye, actually a plastic eye, but she's using that glass eye as the metaphor, the ability to, it implies the ability to be broken. And that works very well throughout this memoir. Dan, this is the kind of writing that I really enjoy. She draws you in with very vivid descriptions. The emotions are there on the page. And the effect of having these vignettes one after another at first seem disconnected, but really they are a metaphor, too, for the state of her mind and the feeling of grief and the way she's remembering her family and putting things together. I think it really has wide appeal, and it's very well crafted. Again, the book is called The Glass Eye, a memoir by Jeannie Venasco.
Paula Gallagher is a librarian in the Baltimore County Public Library System, and she recommends a book a week here on Roughly Speaking. Jeannie Venasco, the author of the memoir The Glass Eye, published by Tin House Books, is teaching three courses at Towson this fall, writing creative nonfiction, topics in writing form and experimentation in memoir, and the theory of creativity. So now, do we go to Gertrude's kitchen or do we chat with Sherry Parks? Let's save John Shields and Gertrude's for the last course today, okay? Let's talk to Sherry about, well, you'll hear what we're going to talk about. We rambled and rolled from an NFL quarterback out of a job to the growing list of high-profile men accused of sexually assaulting women, to the modern meaning of masculinity. So, Sherry, Colin Kaepernick ends up on the cover of GQ as their Citizen of the Year. Big afro, black leather jacket, great expression on his face. And it sort of was in your face, wasn't it, this cover?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you mean by the look on his face? How did you read that?
I was trying to describe it. I said serious doesn't really do it justice. It's
kind of contemplative.
It was, and I'm still here. It says, yeah. I'm still here, and let's push the reset button here so you understand what this protest was about.
Well, and
that's what I get out of it.
And he looks resilient. He doesn't look like
that. Yeah, he looks good.
I mean, we've seen people who have been at the middle of media storms, and he doesn't have that beaten down look. He doesn't look persecuted. He looks,
right.
I'm still standing.
Yeah, this is not Colin Kaepernick in exile.
No.
Right?
No.
This is Colin Kaepernick. I'm still out here. In fact, There's photographs of him in Harlem. With kids.
With children, yeah. And lifting two of them up on his arms. And you know, it's GQ, so he's wearing all of these very expensive athletic clothes for the most part, except for the leather jacket. But he's also displaying his body. And I had not paid attention to the tattoos on his chest. I'm not sure I've seen his chest.
I've seen them on his arms from a distance. I don't know what they say. And you looked into this.
Well, yeah, I looked it up, and there were several articles about the tattoos on Kaepernick's chest. And one, there's the one in the middle that says, "Against all odds." But then the other ones are Bible verses from Psalms, several of them, that his parents helped him pick out. And they're really interesting.
Can you quote them?
Yeah, I pulled them up. "Though an army besiege me, my heart will not fear. Though war break out against me, even then I will be confident."
I'm empowered by God against all odds.
And that God is with me. And his mother actually, in the article I found, interpreted it. His mom helped him pick it out. And she says, "They are about asking God to help kick somebody's butt." Which is kind of funny when you think about football, but if you recontextualize it now, because they're basically all from Psalms, which is a lot of, you know, "Though I walk through the valley, you know, God is with me." And so that, with the look on his face and the article about this guy who really is simply standing up for something he believes.
You appear to be impressed, as I am, that they're just not tattoos with like lyrics from rap songs or something, that they're taken from the Bible.
Well, he thought about it.
He thought about it. So this is increasingly looking like a man of depth, right? As if we needed more proof of that. It seemed to me that people didn't give him an opportunity, really, to say what his protest was about much. He gave some interviews, limited interviews, and then suddenly there was all this condemnation, mostly from white football fans who do not like hearing too much about police officers shooting unarmed black men.
Well, because you know, if you're a sports fan, and we have to remind ourselves that fan is short for fanatic, if you go to the football game, there's supposed to be a suspension of
real life?
Of real life, yes, yes. And it's interesting because you don't think of it as being the same as the movie theater, which everybody knows they're going in to suspend real life to some degree. There's a dream state. But when you enter the arena, there is that same thing. Lots of people, including athletes, like to say that race stops at the door, that we're all equal on the field.
Do you think it's a fair complaint of people to say, "I want a respite from all the complicated, complex, ugly news that's out there, issues in our society, and just give me a break here at the football game"?
I think it's a fair thing to say. I think only can you rest if you're sure that everybody who's working in that arena is getting a fair shot. I also don't think that just because you play football, you lose your First Amendment rights to speak. I think, and one of the reasons I was interested in the religious language is that taking a knee, which has been deemed very offensive, has always seemed reverent to me. And I learned that it's actually something that the military does for fallen soldiers. They get down on one knee. And so the imagery of him looking prayerful to me now makes more sense.
There are photographs from the civil rights movement, too, showing Dr. King and his comrades during protests or march taking a knee.
Right.
Wherever it was. I've seen several photographs. People have demonstrated on the internet that this is not new. Actually.
It has context.
Yeah.
Right. And then, of course, one of the reasons it's important for him to speak out is that it got co-opted by the president. And so it became, the president of the United States is now weighing in on, you know, how players position their bodies before games. And it took the narrative. And so I think it was important that Kaepernick was able to come back and say, remember what this was about. But I also think when you talk about how he looks, is that I think we're in the midst of a conversation, again, still, about masculinity. And I think there is, you know, we've equated masculinity with brawn, you know, with basically what happens on the football team, although he's the quarterback, so that's a different role, obviously, and it's an intellectual role.
We equate it with athleticism, muscularity.
Right.
Is that a word, muscularity?
Yes, right, with brawn.
Brawn, but also deep principle, I associate it with that. Character, strong character.
Do you?
Yeah.
Interesting.
You think it mostly has to do with the physical? the ability to shoot a deer? What, provide food for a family?
Well, see,
all that primal stuff?
If you're talking about the larger sense of masculinity,
yeah.
I think that that intellectual character part has been lost to a large degree. And I think that's exactly what Kaepernick and, you know, Barack Obama and other people bring back to the idea of masculinity. And I mean, I have to say, I've thought often.
Well, you have an excellent point there. I'm not saying it exists in abundance, but I think it's part of the definition.
Well,
if somebody says he's a real man, meaning he's a stand-up guy, what's stand-up guy mean? That's part of masculinity.
Well, no, I'm not saying that there are not people who exhibit this in their day-to-day lives. I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying that that's gone away. I'm saying in the public sphere, the people we have looked to for leaders are even public figures, a lot of that seems to have gone away.
Yeah,
that kind of
it was demonstrated a lot this past week and 10 days with the Roy Moore scandal.
You know, yes, because a lot of masculinity, the conversation about masculinity and power have to go hand in hand. And, you know, we've had on display retroactively, because all of this is being pulled out
of the past,
a type of masculinity that was built on the bodies of victims, mostly female bodies, that I have power, therefore I remember, how often have we heard, well, I was a man of my time when you got to do this.
Right, when you got to grab a woman by her rear end.
Right.
Or make comments about her body. Or worse.
So yeah. I think, I mean, that's what I mean, is that we're having these two images of masculinity that are being played up right now. And I think what is missing is the stand-up guy.
This is really interesting to me. So there's an idea of masculinity that is old school. That I think the last time you were here, I told you the story about standing up at a table where I was at lunch with some older men who were, I felt, were abusing the waitress,
mm-hmm.
right? I was younger than these men by 20, almost 30 years,
mm-hmm.
right? And I felt self-righteous in the moment. I felt like, should I say anything? All right, I've said it. Now I'm going to leave the table because I can't sit here the rest of the time with these guys because I just told them that I thought they were a bunch of jerks, right? And that's old school. So so the idea of masculinity in that school was you can pinch the waitress's rear end, right? You can make a comment about somebody. You can try to hit on the waitress when she brings you your martini for lunch. That's some idea of masculinity.
Almost a sport. You weren't interested.
The male privilege.
You weren't interested in her as a person.
No, right. No. Okay. So you're saying that that's up against now this new idea of the principled man.
Well, and I'm not sure it's new, but I think it has.
It's not new. It's.
But that we've almost forgotten it.
Yeah.
Easy
to do in the Trump era.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and I have to say, I keep thinking about my Uncle Johnny. So my father died when I was quite young. But there was a man who, he really was married to my mother's cousin. But he kind of took it upon himself to take an interest in us. And they would come to visit. My mom and his wife would be talking. And Uncle Johnny would just look at me. And then he would say, let's take a walk. And he smelled like peppermint and tobacco. And he would give me a peppermint, and he would ask me what I was thinking. So I was kind of this odd cerebral child, and he would listen, and he would encourage me, and then he would go back, and he would smoke his pipe. I've been thinking about Uncle Johnny a lot this week, of that kind of strong, but I don't have to throw my strength around, but there to support you. And he would always say, well, if you need anything, let me know. And that was kind of the end of our conversation, and he would give me quarters in peppermint. But that kind of, and I'm not saying that women can't display the same thing, but it has traditionally been associated with men, that kind of strength that you don't have to display all the time, but it is there.
You know it's there. It's a solid man. Right?
Right.
A solid guy who is probably very principled, can probably give you some good advice, has thought things through, has decided these are the Ten Commandments of his life and he'll stick to them, right? Somebody like that. You just know from being in their presence and hearing them speak that this is a solid person.
Well, even the phrase you use, the stand-up guy,
yeah.
A stand-up guy is not pushing. A stand-up guy is standing there.
Right. He's got your back.
He's got your back.
Yeah.
And I think that idea of, which is, you know, if we were being very Freudian, is the father of figure. And I know men like this. And we've talked about this crisis in masculinity, that men now don't know what to do now that women's roles have changed so much. And I think I'm seeing this. That he's standing there being strong, being intelligent, being physically attractive too, which, you know, for GQ helps a lot. But there actually was, of the articles that accompanied this piece in GQ, they talked to other people who talked about Kaepernick. And one of them was his life partner, who is a social activist. And she talks about their talking and, you know, that he really believes what he's doing. And so that idea that is, you're strong, but you also are highly principled. What happened to principles? Do you remember them? Could that be the new masculinity, the renewed masculinity? That would be really nice.
You gotta be careful here, because he's been penalized for this.
And yet he's standing up.
He's standing up, but he's been penalized. He's unable to earn an income right now from what he does best at this time in his life. So
what do you mean, be careful? That the cautionary tale is not to be strong, is not to be intelligent, to...
Yeah, there are consequences for having principles, for standing up and being in the face of the convention.
I'm going to make a prediction that 10 years from now, we'll look back and say, oh, that's where he came from, because I think he's going to be bigger than this. It would be great if he could be a quarterback. The league actually could use him, right?
Yes. But the league could use some excitement. Yeah.
But I think he will go to bigger things. I mean, we all know that football players and dancers have a limited lifespan in their career. I mean, what do you do
Correct.
After that? Yeah. And I think he will be doing something more.
Sherry Parks is an associate dean in American Studies at the University of Maryland, College Park. She joins us once a month to talk about aspects of American culture. John Shields and Henry Hong join us once a month to talk about food. Henry couldn't get here this month, something about having an appliance delivered to his house. And I decided to visit John at Gertrude's instead of having him come to the Sun. So here we go, a visit to the kitchen at Gertrude's. Not really. We're in Gertrude's kitchen, where the crew is getting ready for lunch. To convince everybody that we're actually in this kitchen, we need to make some noise.
Okay, Yolanda, could you chop real loud for us?
Yolanda, what's Yolanda chopping?
Some onions?
What are you making?
Oyster stew.
Onions for the oyster stew?
Yes, sir.
What else goes into the oyster stew?
Celery, a little bit of cayenne, and onions.
What else? She's got some tomatoes there, too.
What's that? Cream and milk.
That's it?
Bacon fat.
Bacon fat. Yeah, if I stand here long enough, we'll get all the ingredients.
Yeah.
Hey, what is a robot coupe?
Here, come on. Steve wants to come into the Robocoo right here. Come on in.
Robocoo?
Yeah, the Robocoo.
Is that the Robocoupe?
No. Really,
all right, so that's a machine. This is Steve?
Yeah, this is Steve.
Yolanda, this is Steve. So what's Steve? What are you doing?
I'm making a pecan encrusted topping for the trout today.
A pecan encrusted trout?
Trout for the fish special, yes, sir.
Wow. That's a machine chopping up the pecans.
Yeah, pulsates very fine pieces. It's really good. It's a very...
It gives you almost like a granola looking thing. Yeah.
Yes.
Very nice. Thank you very much for demonstrating the robot coupe.
It's a super Cuisinart, and you can put things in there that you tear them up that you couldn't tear up in a Cuisinart.
So I think people are convinced now that we are in the kitchen. Can we go down here where it's really hot? What's going on down here, John?
Pedro's over here. He's making a butter sauce, a shallot butter sauce.
Hola, Pedro.
Hola.
Ooh, that looks good. Shallot and butter sauce for what?
We usually use it for a number of the fish, some of the salmon dishes. You can top it. So you're basically taking white wine and shallots, all kinds of herbs, a little vinegar, reducing it way down. And as you can see, he's swirling in a ton of butter at this point.
That is beautiful. It smells so good, too. Yeah. And is that a enameled cast iron?
It is. It is. You know, whenever you're making kind of like a beurre blanc or something butter like that, it's best to use the enamel one. It heats better, and it also doesn't react with the metal. So it's good.
Very nice. Do you mind clattering some pans or pots, just so people understand that we're actually still in Gertrude's kitchen? Thank you, Pedro. Gracias. And what's inside the giant pot?
This is Yolanda. She's starting her Maryland crab soup.
What are we looking at? I see tomatoes. Yeah, I see tomatoes. Celery.
Celery. And then she's got you know how she always has something secret here? Let's pull this.
Yolanda always has something secret in the pot.
Oh, my God.
John, what is that?
She's got...
What are you trying to pull out of there?
Ham hocks. She's got all kinds of bones that she flavors the stock while she's making it.
Is that authorized? You seem surprised to find that in there.
Well, it's just heavier than I thought.
That is a big piece
of
ham.
That's a big thing. God knows what she found, but it's in there.
Oh, wow. So there's a little tip for someone making crab soup.
It is.
For your stock, use smoked ham?
Smoked ham or a little ham hock. I got that from Miss Jean Chigoris down at Nick's Inner Harbor Seafood.
Oh, Tommy's mom.
Tommy's mom, yeah. Yeah, so this is Miss Jean's crab soup right there.
Working further down the galley here that we come to... the French fries, okay. all hand-cut.
Hand-cut, and they're blanched.
Wait a minute. Hand-cut or hands on a machine that cut them?
Hand-cut on a machine.
Hand-cut on a machine.
And then Manas is blanching it in the oil here. So the oil's like a lower temperature than you would usually fry at. Normally, you're going to be frying at about 375.
You mean if you were frying chicken?
Yeah, but we take it down to about 275, 300 degrees. You blanch them for a little bit, put them on a sheet tray, and then we chill them. And then when you're ready, when it's time for the...
Finish.
It'll be up at about 375. You put them in there, and boom. And that's what makes them really crisp. The blanching is really important. And you can also see here, Manas has this thing.
Let me describe this. It's a big white plastic barrel with a liquid inside.
Yeah, so
it's
sort of a
dingy liquid. But John just put his hand in it. And what are you reaching for, John?
Just a little the French fries, because he puts them in there. It washes off the starch.
What is that?
Water.
It's just water.
Just water. And then you take, after you do that, you take and you dry them a little bit before you actually blanch them. So
that's an interesting process.
Cut them, wash them, blanch them, and then when you're ready to go, fry them.
I think people who do French fries well, meaning the French,
yeah,
they know this, that you fry them twice.
You have to.
And your process is really interesting. What kind of potato do you use for French fries?
Right now we're using a number 2 Idaho potato.
The number 2 Idaho, one of my favorites. Yeah, all right, now we're going back into a very small room, another small room. Well, actually, it's not a small room. This is a large room. This is your pantry.
Idaho, U.S. number 2.
Right.
There you go.
And we're in the pantry where all your supplies are in here. Onions, red onions. All kinds of things.
Sweet potatoes. We have everything back here. You know, keep all the spice. Okay. Everything from Asia food. You need things from Asia food just to make things
so
good.
Go to Asia food.
Absolutely.
Do you pick up stuff in Asia food?
I love Asia food.
It's on York Road, the one on York Road.
Uh-huh, that's my hangout.
Yeah.
And so, we keep everything else back here that doesn't fit in a walk-in, has to come back here.
John Shields actually put together a whole menu for Thanksgiving. And you're thinking, okay, I got to do the Thanksgiving food. And you probably have already thought this out. If you invited people over, you've probably been thinking what your menu looks like. But John has some neat things to offer here. Why don't we start with the stuffing and go right through your list?
All right. Well,
because you've written so much about the Chesapeake, I'm not surprised that your stuffing involves oysters.
It has, like a little bit of oysters in it. It's pretty typical. There's two ways to go with it. You can go with the stale white bread, the toasted white bread. Then you do your sauté, a little bit of onions and carrots and celery, maybe some garlic. Sauté that, get it nice and limp.
You're sautéing in butter?
In butter, yeah. And then put it in with the bread cubes. And you just toss in it together and then put a little salt and pepper. Then towards the end, after I make that part, I'll take like a pint of oysters and take about half of them and I chop them up. Then I fold that into the bread mixture. And then I leave some of the other ones a little bit coarse. You know, maybe cut them into half or to quarter, depending on the size. And then put that in there as well. Toss that into the mixture as well.
So, you don't chop them too much because you don't want to lose the idea of the oyster in that stuffing, right?
Exactly. You know, some of it you want just in there for taste. Some you want for texture. And then I always make sure to save the oyster liquor that's in the thing. And then I kind of just drizzle it all over the bread cubes, give a little bit more flavor. It's like the super concentrated oyster stock. I mean, it's unbelievable. Then toss that together. Now, some of my friends will pour a little bacon grease in there. Other people will just take some chopped bacon and toss it in. I don't usually do that, but many people will do it. And I have other friends that do it. Same thing we just said, but instead of using the white bread crouton, they'll use a cornbread crouton. And so you got an oyster cornbread stuffing. So you can go any way that you want to. You're still just doing the same process.
Question for you. Does that go inside the turkey, or is that a standalone stuffing?
Well, as I don't want to be hauled away by the Food and Drug Administration, I have to tell you that you should cook that in a separate pan, wrap it up nice and tight, and make sure that it's heated very well.
Because it's not recommended generally anymore that you stuff a turkey and roast it.
It's not, because some of the fear is that when you put it into the turkey, and especially if
a raw turkey,
and you pack it tightly, as it roasts, it creates a perfect temperature for bacteria to grow in there, and often it doesn't get hot enough in the center of the stuffing to kill the bacteria. So it's really probably a good idea to do it on the side.
And think about it for a minute. What are you gaining by cooking or roasting a turkey with the stuffing? I guess the thought is you're gaining some flavor in the stuffing, but look at what you just put into that stuffing. It doesn't need anything else.
There's plenty of flavor in this. There really is. So why take the chance? You know, it doesn't make any sense.
We'll provide a link on the podcast, in the podcast notes, to John's recipe, full recipe for the oyster stuffing. I really like the use of cornbread in that.
Yeah.
What else is on your menu? You don't have to go into each in detail, but list what's there.
We have a corn pudding. I have some maple baked sweet potato, you know, like a candied sweet potato.
That's so much better than marshmallow. What is it with marshmallow and sweet potatoes, John? What is this?
They went crazy somewhere in the 60s and 70s about these marshmallows, and you know, for some people, it's a tradition.
It's like Formstone. You know, they came to Baltimore and sold people on Formstone. And sometime around the same era, I think in the 50s, they sold people on marshmallow and sweet potato.
I think they did. And it stuck with many families. Ours it never did. But
I actually don't like it. The idea of maple excites me.
Yeah.
Anything maple. Maple ice cream, maple syrup, maple coffee, maple tea, maple anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really easy because you're basically making a maple syrup with some brown sugar, maple, and I grate some orange rind into it too, and squeeze an orange into it, and then just bake the sweet potatoes in it. It's awesome.
What else is on your list?
I also have a black walnut pie. It's kind of like a pecan pie. But using the black walnuts. Now, for people that think that they're too
strong, they're not hard to get. You can get bags of black walnuts.
Yeah, especially around this time of the year, because they go rancid rather quickly because they have a high oil content. But if you're going to use them quickly or use them in a short period of time, they're great. But if you think that they're a little too strong, you could mix it, you know, like 50% regular walnuts, the English walnuts, and 50% the black. But I think it gives...
Is it similar to a pecan pie?
It is. It is. It has the same kind of consistency and stuff. So, I mean, I'm not saying replace your pumpkin pie with it. I'm saying in addition, you can have that.
I'm a mincemeat guy.
Oh,
do you like mincemeat?
Oh, that's my favorite thing in the world. And
have you ever made mincemeat, or do you always buy a jar of it?
I made it... a couple of times, and you know, it was delicious, but I think I've been using the non-such or mincemeat.
That's the one I bought.
Because my grandmother Gertie used to get that, and I chase those people at the Giant down every year. And so the game is find the mincemeat. It's a great game.
You mean where it is in the store?
Yeah, and every year,
you can
nobody
stump.
Knows, yeah. And so it's the game. It's my year in the game.
You can stump the guy or the woman that stocks the shelves there by asking where the mincemeat is.
Yeah, and do you use it just as it is in the jar, or do you do anything different to it?
No, I just take it right out of the jar.
You know what I started doing a little while ago? Is I'll take two apples, and I peel them, and I dice them. I dust it just a little bit in flour, just so that too much moisture doesn't come out. and then I fold that into the mincemeat. And so the pie's really high then. So you're kind of getting this apple mincemeat pie. It's really good.
That's a good idea because mincemeat pie can look sort of flat, right?
Yeah. Very good, John. So, and then I don't let people eat it. I mean, I let them taste a little bit of it because I save it because it's for me. For the next day and the next day because I eat it for breakfast every day. It's my favorite.
It's great, isn't it? I love it. What else is on your menu?
That was about it. We do have a recipe there for roast goose in case you're aren't feeling so inclined to your turkey, but it's a little bit more, you know, it's a little bit more difficult to get the goose.
So we have all the recipes in one place.
You have the recipe, and if you're missing a recipe and you need one last minute, we got a bunch of them. It should take care of just about anything.
John, thanks very much. Things are heating up here in the kitchen. The big pot of crab soup, I can feel it on my back.
It's good, isn't it?
Actually feels good, yeah.
It does.
But thank you very much, and have a great Thanksgiving.
And same to you, Dan. Thank you.
Behind you.
Behind me. Hop, you hear him? Hop behind me. I'm glad he said that. The Thanksgiving recipes John refers to appeared in the Bay Weekly about a week back. Go to the notes with this podcast, and you'll find a link to them there. Tomorrow on the show, a podcast tour of Maryland's vineyards and wineries, all 70 of them, with Kevin Addix of the Maryland Wineries Association. Kevin shares a little bit about each place and mentions the best wines that each vineyard produces. I had no idea Maryland had 70 wineries, and I'm guessing I'm not alone in that regard. So we're offering a little bit of info about each one in case you're looking to buy local for the holidays or you want to start planning your vineyard tours for next year. So we'll see you for that. That's our show for now. The producers of Roughly Speaking are Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and sometimes Christina Tasek. This is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. We really appreciate that. And we'll see you again soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.